Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The October 2014 term of the U.S. Supreme Court concluded yesterday. It was a momentous year, and it concluded yesterday with the court upholding Oklahoma and several other states' use of midazolam as a sedative in carrying out of death sentences. Also found the EPA in violation of the Clean Air Act for not using cost-benefit analysis in restricting mercury and other heavy metal emissions from power plants. And also upheld Arizona voters' removal of legislative redistricting responsibilities from the legislature to a new nonpartisan commission. Of course, the most important decisions of the term were Obergefell versus Hodges, which granted same-sex marriage rights under the Constitution, and King versus Burwell, which allowed tax subsidies for health insurers who are not covered by state insurance exchanges under the Affordable Care Act. Joining me to discuss the court's decisions this term is the new incoming dean of the University of Tulsa Law School and constitutional law specialist Lynn Inseroth. Professor Inseroth will assume the deanship tomorrow here at the University of Tulsa, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Lynn Inseroth, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. Pleasure to be here.
And congratulations on being the new dean of the University of Tulsa Law School. Commentators and reporters have referred, they're using such terms as historic, momentous, to describe this Supreme Court term. Now, as a constitutional law scholar, is it momentous? Will we think that 5, 10, 25 years down the road?
I think there's some momentous decisions that we are going to be reading about, thinking about, and affecting our lives in the coming years.
Obviously, the big cases were announced in the last couple of days. Obergefell versus Hodges, which constitutionally guarantees the right to same-sex marriage. And of course, this was probably the big case. Any surprises in how the court decided in this particular case for you?
I do think everyone was expecting that Justice Kennedy would be the swing vote, and he was. He was joined with the four more liberal members of the court, Justice Sotomayor, Justice Breyer, Justice Kagan, and Justice Ginsburg, in finding that the right for same-sex couples to marry was protected under the Constitution. Everyone thought he was key, and he was. The four dissenters were also very much expected to dissent from this type of decision, and that would have been Justice Scalia, Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Alito, and Justice Thomas.
And the dissenting opinions sort of show how divided this court was on this issue, because it was almost personal at times.
It was. It was a very hard-fought battle. And the justices, certainly in the dissent, had some very strong responses to the majority of the opinion.
Roberts' minority opinion, which this is, you know, this is a great day to celebrate if you believe in this, but it's not a great day for the Constitution. Don't celebrate the Constitution. The Constitution had nothing to do with it, which is pretty blunt language in an opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is very interesting. I mean, I think one of the themes of the dissenters is that the court was acting like a legislature. The court was being activists. And when you refer to a court being activists, you're usually referring to a court that is handing down decisions that overturn state or federal legislation. And certainly this was an activist decision in that it overturned state legislation. But the Roberts Court and Chief Justice Roberts and the justices who joined him in dissent have handed down plenty of activist decisions. So that argument that it's activists often is one made by the dissenter.
Losing, losing side.
Yeah. And I think the response of Justice Kennedy and the majority would be, yes, but when the Constitution protects someone's constitutionally protected rights, then that's the job of the court. That is what the court is supposed to do, step in and overturn legislation that violates the Constitution. And there's a longstanding tension between the democratic process and what the people's views are, and those constitutional rights that we all hold and that the majority cannot take away from us.
Through history, the Supreme Court generally, when it tackles an issue like this, I think of Brown versus Board of Education, major social policy issues at the heart of the case. Most of the time, the court tries to be unanimous. When you read about the deliberations in Brown versus Board, it was a 5-4 decision, and basically Earl Warren cajoled, manipulated the opinion, massaged it to get the four dissenters to become a part of the majority. So they spoke with one single voice, and that's happened several times in our history. No chance of this, it seems like, and it seems like it, maybe not even an effort was made, or it was just too black and white for members of the court. Was that surprising to you?
I wasn't surprised that it was a 5-4 decision, but I do think you make an excellent point about when the court hands down major social decisions that change the fabric of the country. Brown versus Board of Education is a great example. That was a 9-0 decision ending segregation, legalized segregation in the country. And as the moral leader on this issue, as the moral authority of what the Constitution means, Earl Warren and the other justices on the court thought it was incredibly important that that message was sent. They did that again in a case called Loving versus Virginia, which was from 1967, in which the Supreme Court struck down state laws that forbid marriages between African Americans and white Americans, right? That forbid interracial marriage.
Of course, that was a footnote for this lawsuit as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I just don't think we had a court that had all the justices lined up to make that stand this time.
Yeah. No, the other thing that was interesting to me is this was not the first opportunity for this court to hear this case. They let stand a circuit court of appeals ruling which legalized gay marriage within that circuit. They did not take the case then. They had another case in another court of appeals circuit. They didn't take that case. They said nothing. And only when they had a divided circuit court did they agree to take this on. You think this was ducking the issue until they couldn't duck it? Do you think it was strategy on, you know, among either the minority or majority of when do we bring this case before us?
You know, that's a great question. Now, I wish I had inside information about what was motivating all the justices.
And eventually we'll read this in a book,
yeah,
I'm sure.
But I don't have that yet. But I can tell you what it looks like, you know, what I would see this as. I would think that I'm not sure if the court was ducking the question, but at least enough of the justices thought it's not ready. It's not where we want it to be. Certainly by the time we had the decision from the Sixth Circuit finding that barriers to same-sex marriage do not violate the Constitution, then the court had to take it up because we had divided circuits on that issue. But there is strategy that goes into granting cert. The Supreme Court gets thousands of petitions before them each year asking them to hear a case. And the court has almost complete discretion as to whether or not to pick that case.
You have to have four justices. You have to
Absolutely.
Have a sizable minority.
Right, to do that. And they only, I think this year, decided 69 cases. So a very small sliver. So yes, strategy goes into what cases are selected. And the politicking that you talked about that we saw in Brown versus Board of Education, that politicking also goes into the decision, at least on the big blockbuster cases, about when to grant cert.
I think if you stood back from the controversy over this, I think once that First Circuit Court decision was upheld, you said, well, eventually when this comes before them, it's going to lead to the legalization, because if you were adamantly opposed against it, you're setting all this policy into motion in various parts of the states, and you have all these sorts of issues over whether how do you recognize it, do you recognize it, do you not recognize it. And if they would have ruled against this, it would have been crazy, I think.
I agree. And I think some of the things that the Supreme Court did prior to handing down this decision sort of tipped their hands. For example, they refused to enjoin states from the court opinions that required states to allow same-sex marriage. And what would have happened? Had the court ruled the other way, what would have happened to all those marriages, those legal, valid marriages that had occurred during that interim? So I think sort of the way it was all getting played out across the country in courts, in people going to get married, I think it would have made it extremely difficult for the court to have ruled the other way.
Let's look at the other big case that came down at the end of the term, and that is King versus Burwell, which allows states who are not having their own exchange for health insurance purposes allow the residents of their state to collect federal tax subsidies. And this allows this to happen. And of course, the heart of it, and if you listen to either side, it's either a law is a law, and what the law says is the law, or this was poor drafting, it was a clerical error, and this should never have been in court in the first place, depending on where your place on the political spectrum is. But I do want to contrast it. It was a 6-3 decision which upheld this. I want to contrast it with a case of maybe 10 years ago or more, maybe just slightly over, and it was a Rehnquist court decision, the Lilly Ledbetter case, in which the court held at that particular time that the law was a law. And in that particular case, Lilly Ledbetter had suffered discrimination in pay compared to somebody holding the same job. When she found out about it, she filed suit. When it went to the Supreme Court, you look at the law was drafted in a way in which it could be interpreted as saying, well, she would have had to file suit within 60 or 90 days of the start of the discrimination, not when she found out about it. Now, the law's intent, in fact, Congress actually changed this after this decision was rendered, but the law's intent was obviously to allow her to file a suit. But the Supreme Court then said, no, the law is the law. So this is a really interesting turnaround, what, 10 years or so later?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. In the Lilly Ledbetter case, the way the court interpreted the statute really made the statute make no sense anymore. You were supposed to file a complaint within this certain time limit, even though you didn't know that you had been injured, which would have been impossible to do. And you're absolutely right. Congress went back in and corrected it. And there was a lot of criticism in the media for the way the court decided that case, interpreted a statute so it didn't give effect to the intent of Congress, so that it resulted in sort of a nonsensical way of making the law work. And in this current case now, this is the Affordable Care Act. A couple years ago, we had the constitutional attack on the Affordable Care Act. It survived that, with Chief Justice Roberts handing down the opinion that made it survive the constitutional attack. This was the statutory attack. And the Affordable Care Act is 1,000 pages. And this was four words in that 1,000-page document. And the Chief Justice, in his opinion for six justices, said, the intent of the statute, the way it's structured, requires these subsidies, and we are not going to construe it in a way that defeats that. And you're right, that's an interesting comparison between here the court is looking at the full intent of the statute in making that decision. Now, one difference between the two statutes is the Affordable Care Act is one, just a much bigger statute and a very complicated statute, and a statute that Chief Justice Roberts pointed out has many inartful moments. And having read through the statute, it is true. Many inartful moments and inartful uses of language in there. Also, this affects a lot more people. The effect, if the court had ruled against the Affordable Care Act here, it would have had huge effect across the country. And it would have had huge political effects, both for Democrats and for Republicans. So I think the effect of ruling that this aspect of the statute was invalid was probably a lot higher stakes.
My guest today is Lynn Ensoroth, the new incoming dean of the University of Tulsa Law School and a constitutional law specialist. We're looking at the review of the recently concluded Supreme Court term for 2014-2015, which people are describing as momentous. We've talked about some of the big cases. And in both of those cases we've talked about, Oklahoma did have sort of, if not an official dog in the fight, they had a dog in the fight. Another case where we really did have a dog in the fight came down yesterday, and that is the death penalty case, which the conservative side of the court, 5-4, upheld the state's use of midazolam as a sedative in carrying out a death sentence. Were you surprised at all? I mean, the Supreme Court has not really intervened on the side of commuting death sentences very often in recent memory, even going back to the Rehnquist Court. So this was not a big surprise, was it?
Well, now, Glossop was another 5-4 decision, and it actually was a pretty emotional decision. The language in both the majority and the dissenting's opinions were very emotional, and in fact, the oral argument was a very heated oral argument. I think also because it came down on Monday, the last day of term for the court, I think it reflects what a struggle this case was for the court. Now, the Supreme Court has never found a particular form of execution to violate the cruel and unusual punishment clause of the Eighth Amendment, although the court has said that executions that would include torture, a torturous way of imposing the death penalty, that that could violate the Eighth Amendment. Justice Alito wrote the majority opinion. And one of the first things he says is, if the death penalty is constitutional, then there has to be a constitutional method to carry it out. And he found that the petitioners here failed to show that lethal injection protocol that's used in Oklahoma had a demonstrated risk of severe pain and a risk that is substantial compared to other available methods of execution. he said, first, the petitioners hadn't shown that. And secondly, he said that the petitioners would have to show here's the form of execution that works. He put that burden then on the individuals to be executed and their lawyers to come up with another means rather than putting that burden on the state.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting because this has been the turmoil in the state. If this was declared unconstitutional, how do we do this? Alito said basically, well, you as a petitioner, you have to tell me the right way to do this, to carry out the sentence. We're not going to even look at the sentence. Although there were dissenting opinions, which looked at the whole entirety of the death penalty, and then Scalia wrote in response to the dissent saying, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, it very much says. We have our dissenters were Justice Breyer, Ginsburg, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Kagan. And Justice Breyer and Justice Ginsburg joined in an opinion written, or dissenting opinion written by Justice Breyer, in where Justice Breyer really looked at the death penalty. It was a very long dissenting opinion, a very exacting dissent, discussing various aspects of the death penalty. And he really came to the end that he believes it is highly likely that the death penalty today violates the Eighth Amendment, and that at the very least, the court should look at whether or not the death penalty today would violate the Eighth Amendment. Now, Justice Sotomayor wrote the dissent in which Justice Kagan and also Breyer and Ginsburg joined. And she says at the very beginning that the method of execution exposes the defendants to what she called the equivalent of being burned at the stake. I mean, that's very dramatic language, very graphic language. So I think this was a case that troubled members of the court, that was difficult for members of the court, that shows that the death penalty is a question that the court struggles with and is continuing to struggle with.
Now, these were the big sort of cases that came down at the end of the term, but there were a number of other cases which I think could have some long-term influence. A couple on how you create districts, voting districts. Mm-hmm. One came down here at the end, the Arizona case, which is Arizona State Legislature versus the Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission. Now, the story of this was that citizens stripped the legislature of the right to create congressional districts and voting districts. They said, we want to have a nonpartisan commission that will sort of come up with the best districts. You won't see these little snake-like districts in which, you know, certain neighborhoods are included and certain neighborhoods are moved out, because basically this idea of block, let's just get as nonpartisan as we can. The legislature said, no, this is our authority, and they sued. And the Supreme Court held that citizens can strip the legislature of the right to create voting districts. This case could really have some influence down the road, because there's several other states that allow nonpartisan commissions to do their electoral districts. And the idea is that you get some of the partisanship out of whatever body the election districts are, whether it's legislature or congressional districts. What are your thoughts on this decision today?
Yeah, you know, this is an interesting decision, and it's an issue in some ways that the court has grappled with districting in other contexts as well. Now, whether it's the Democrats who have the majority of the state house or the Republicans who have the majority of the state house, one of a longstanding concern that many folks have had is that when the districts are redrawn after the census, that they're drawn to favor the party in power. And in fact, my understanding is that the Republicans in the Arizona State House were upset because they thought that it didn't give them enough of an advantage or gave the Democrats too much advantage. And really, the citizens of Arizona were trying to take that partisanship out of it so that there would be a nonpartisan and perhaps more rational, perhaps, in the view of the citizens, way of drawing those districts. And the courts finding approval with this, or at least certainly find that there's nothing wrong constitutionally with doing this, I think gives citizens another way to control the redistricting process to assure that more citizens are happy with the way their districts are drawn.
Now, there was a related case involving a couple of cases in Alabama which were filed suit because actually that legislature had relied too much on race in redistricting. So basically, you were concentrating African-American populations across the state into one sort of snake-like district. Mm-hmm. Which would elect a black congressman, but you weren't giving equal weight to other districts of black versus white population. And the court held that basically the lower courts didn't find the right standard for doing this, so they actually sent it back to the lower court.
Yeah, there are two cases out of Alabama challenging the redistricting in that state, which tended to favor the Republicans who held the majority in the state house in Alabama. But it did more than just, according to the petitioners, it did more than just favor the Democrats. It disfavored African Americans or resulted in racial gerrymandering. Now, in some ways, this could be a small case, perhaps, because really it sent it back to the district court to look at this particular issue and to do something different in the fact-finding. The Supreme Court disagreed with how the district court analyzed the gerrymandering or the redistricting. But the court also seemed to indicate that they thought that there were at least some districts in which there had been racial gerrymandering. Racial gerrymandering violates the Constitution. Political gerrymandering could be okay, but not the racial gerrymandering. So I do think it does indicate that the court is looking at that issue.
There were also a number of free speech and religious accommodation cases, most notably Samantha Alof's case here in Tulsa, the EEOC versus Abercrombie and Fitch. That was an 8-1 decision. Were there any surprises in that?
I think that it was that this was not a 5-4 decision was somewhat of a surprise to me as well. Justice Scalia, in his opinion, said, this is an easy case. He said under Title VII, an applicant need only show that his need for an accommodation was a motivating factor in the employer's decision and not that the employer actually knew that she had this need. And so for Justice Scalia, this was very straightforward. And it does show the court's continuing protection of religious rights and religious interest under the First Amendment. And the court has been very protective of those rights, both the conservative justices as well as some of the liberal justices.
And there was one other case along the same lines, Holt versus Hobbs in Arkansas, which correction officials were basically violating the religious liberty rights of Muslim inmates by forbidding them to grow beards over security concerns. And, of course, that was a rare 9-0 decision for the court.
Yes, that was a 9-0 decision. And the court there found really that the prison's explanation for why they were forbidding the half-inch beard, they just didn't buy it. They said that the safety concerns really made no sense. And one of the reasons was because other prisoners were allowed to grow a beard of that length for other reasons. And the court found that again, violated religious freedom interests.
Wow, that's amazing that you could grow the beard for other reasons, but not because you were a Muslim. I mean, it sounds almost like it was that singular.
And I think that really makes it dramatic for the court to see that really this was targeting a religious practice or not accommodating a religious need.
I want to talk about another case. It's a free speech case, and this was somewhat celebrated. It's the Facebook case, Alonis versus the United States, and the court found 8-1 that the prosecutors did not do enough to prove Anthony Alonis' intent when he published threatening rap lyrics directed towards his wife on Facebook. So this could be a major case down the road. The precedence for what you say on the internet, the protections given to things you say on the internet, could end up being cited in multiple court cases down the road, I would think.
Yeah, this is an interesting case. It is about a criminal statute, a federal criminal statute, and whether or not the prosecutors had proved a sufficient intent for him to be criminally punished for what he posted on the internet. And they said, you have to show that he actually had the intent to cause harm rather than just would a reasonable person thought that these words created harm. I think the jury there found, yes, they would. But you have to go further than that, and not just that a reasonable person, but that the defendant actually knew and intended to cause harm. That does place a heavier burden on the government when it comes to prosecuting individuals for their speech on the internet.
One other case I want to mention, kind of an interesting one because it gets to the heart. It's also one of these rare cases where the majority was mixed along the ideological spectrum, mm-hmm. if you will. And this was the separation of powers case involving Zivotofsky versus Kerry. This gets to this longstanding political debate in the House and Senate over where the capital of Israel is. And the United States government does not recognize Jerusalem as the birth as an Israeli birth. And the case here was he wanted to claim Jerusalem as the source of his Israeli birth. The government said no.
Yeah, I mean, this was really a fight between Congress and the president, and not just President Obama. This policy goes back before President Obama, that when an American citizen is born in Jerusalem, which is a divided city, the president and longstanding executive orders would not recognize that individual as having been born in Israel. Then Congress enacted legislation that would say, a policy that would say, yes, you can say that you were born in Israel if you were born in Jerusalem. So we really have a real struggle of power between the president and Congress. And the court here came down on the side of the executive. They reached back and cited a case from the 1930s, Curtis versus Wright, though they didn't go quite as far as that case went or as the Obama administration wanted them to go. But they said when we're talking about matters about whether or not the United States recognizes a nation, that we need to speak with one voice, and that the one voice for that is the executive. And they sided with the president on that particular issue. But we have had this question, this struggle between the power of Congress versus the power of the president. This goes back to the beginning of American history, and that has been a longstanding struggle. In the area of foreign policy, however, there is a pattern of the court deferring or at least recognizing that the executive may have more authority, more power, more a greater need to speak as one voice.
Yeah. Now, were there any other cases you think were important that we haven't talked about?
I think we have covered the major cases that came down. It was an interesting term. It'll be interesting to see what happens next. I think several of the decisions that handed down are just the next stage of litigation, particularly the same-sex marriage case. I am confident that there is going to be further litigation on issues related to this.
All right. Lynn Ensoroth, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. It was a pleasure.
Professor Lynn Ensoroth, constitutional law specialist and the new incoming dean of the University of Tulsa Law School, reviewing the October 2014 term of the U.S. Supreme Court here on Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
Hey, I'm Scott Gregory.
And I'm John Woolley. Our next Hidden 60s radio special celebrates the 50th anniversary of the Beatles at Shea Stadium.
We've got greats, near greats, and obscurities doing the music of the Fab Four, from the Beach Boys to Mae West, from Chet Baker to the Burbank Philharmonic.
So join us here at 8 p.m. Friday, July 3rd on Public Radio Tulsa for our latest presentation of songs you haven't heard since the 60s, if you've heard them at all.
The Hidden 60s Summer Special.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.